1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 26, page 156. Just a phrase, verse 26, it's an imperative, a command, which I hope you will do, not just while I speak, but as a result of what I say, or rather Paul says. Verse 26 of 1 Corinthians 1, 4, consider your calling, brethren. Consider your call, Christian people. Now, on these four Sunday mornings, I'm beginning a rescue operation. It's actually a long, year-long job in which I want, if possible, to restore 1 Corinthians to the churches it ought to be. And that's not just my job, of course. I'm thankful to say that at last, after, I suppose, three generations, there is a magnificent commentary on 1 Corinthians by Gordon Fee. Alas, it all went up in flames with many other books of which you have heard in the recent fire of a Christian publisher's warehouse. But we have languished for at least three generations without a decent commentary on 1 Corinthians, and largely the letter is only used by certain people for their purposes, or the devotional side used as help to us in our Christian walk. But the understanding of this letter has lagged far behind, and so that's the reason for this little series, that at least we should take a look at one chapter and get some idea of what it's for. You know, these books of the Bible badly need rescuing, don't they? On Thursday, we have Roy Clements, as you've already heard, and this week we had two of the most brilliant lectures I think I probably ever heard on Daniel 1 and 6. And if you ask me what they did for me, they rescued Daniel from the Sunday school. Don't tell the Sunday school that. They might be rather offended. But, you know, we really must not let Daniel and the lion's den belong simply to the Sunday school. It's a word very much for the church today. It was very mind-stretching, very nourishing stuff, and indeed very startling, as Roy made a kind of prophecy of the next coronation. If it is long delayed, maybe in 15 or 20 years, when King Charles III is crowned King of England, and present are Muslim leaders and Hindu leaders and other religious leaders, and as Roy said, probably no room for the Archbishop of Canterbury. Well, it's a startling thought, isn't it? And could easily come to pass in the days in which we live. And Daniel chapter 1 and chapter 6 are all about that. And if you want something mind-stretching in the journeys in your car, some of you, I would earnestly ask you to get those tapes and listen to them for yourself. Now, 1 Corinthians is a letter for times of new life in the churches, also of times of great confusion. I like to put it that 1 Corinthians is for Christian adolescence. Adolescence is a delightful time, isn't it, as youngsters shoot up at the age of 13, 14, 15, but it's a dangerous time too, when so many things that were believed are put on one side, and where people can go quite the wrong direction with this new strength and energy. And 1 Corinthians is very like that, and our church today is very like that. There is new life everywhere, and that person who can't see that and denies that, and there are Christians of the ultra-reformed variety who seem to be incapable of seeing the new life that is everywhere, I don't want to blind my eyes to it, but the new life is there. It is life of great confusion. And we have two illustrations of that this very week, don't we? The controversy you may have read if you read a daily paper concerning the 10-to-8 thought for the day, in which Beverly McKench, and some of you will remember her as a member of our congregation, a Christian who is the producer of 10 to 8 each morning, is pleading with a number of her most famous speakers to make their talks more theological and less political. And the balloon went up when Canon Eric James refused to speak anymore under that heading. Well, we really have got fairly confused, haven't we? When a well-known church leader, who's received a great deal of support in the leader columns of our daily papers this week, says that he can't speak on 10 to 8 because he's been asked to be theological. Added confusion, of course, has been going on in the Docklands, as many of you know, and we shall be hearing more about that at our press supper tomorrow night. And what's been happening over 10 to 8 and what's been happening in the Docklands is all signs of new life flowing back into atrophied churches, and with it also a great deal of confusion as to where that life belongs and what it really means. Now, I think that's what this letter is talking about, and it is, as Paul starts his letter, by looking at the message of Christianity. That was our subject last week, and then the membership of the church, which is our subject this week. No one can pretend that these paragraphs, famous as they are, are easy. The actual meaning of them is not initially very difficult, but you certainly do have to do a lot of disciplined detection if you're going to find out what he's really getting at. For example, last week, at the heart of it, verse 22 and 23, in case you weren't with us, is really very simple. It says that Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom. That's what the people of the world of his society demanded. But we apostles, says Paul, preach Christ crucified. Ah, that's a very simple message. They want us to say this, but we say that. And it's easy, isn't it, as Christians in the evangelical tradition, to say this bravely and sincerely today. Indeed, we at St. Helens do, by the grace of God, want to say just that. That we want to go on preaching Christ crucified, as we've sung about Christ crucified. We want to say, in other words, exactly what Paul is saying in verse 23. But, of course, as Paul points out, to say that in terms of common sense is just madness. If you conducted your business on Monday as we conduct our preaching at St. Helens on Sunday, your business would be very soon bankrupt. On Monday morning, as a businessman, you cannot ignore the demands of the market. In fact, it is precisely the demands of the people to whom you have to sell your goods that controls what you produce and what you offer. And because that is so obvious, the Corinthians, who wanted to be a lively and growing church, they wanted to have an impact on their society, were tempted to meet the demands all around them for signs and wisdom. Let me give you a very simple example. Marks and Spencers, you may possibly have heard of them, have invaded the city. In a men's clothes shop, you ladies can stop thinking for a moment, and because I'm afraid they haven't done it for you. Now, the demand amongst men is, quite simply, for good suits at a small cost. I suppose 90% of the city gents who come in every day in their grey pinstripe take it off as soon as they get home, and they certainly don't wear it on Saturday and Sunday. Therefore, they want to be able to buy these smart grey suits at small cost, but want a good one. What is too often on offer in the city is a good suit at a high cost or a rotten suit at a small cost that falls to pieces within 2 years. Marks and Spencers actually have managed to give you a good suit at small cost. The result, they boomed. They've only been here 6 months. Already one of the best known of the city men's retailers has closed up, and I expect several more to close up in the next 6 months. The competition of Marks and Spencers is very frightening if you retail men's clothes in the city. So I want to say from St. Helens pulpit, it may seem an unusual message, look out, all of those of you who run sandwich bars in the city, because Marks and Spencers food is coming to Moorgate very soon. And you will be quite sure that they will meet the demand for sandwiches today, which is very high, and will do it better than anybody else. So if you actually own a sandwich bar, look out. Now, it's the same, of course, with any prophetic preaching, isn't it? Any forecasting of the future. What people want are fair words and high hopes. And that's what a lot of churches give them. People don't like you to alarm them. Yesterday afternoon, exhausted with excitement after the magnificent rugby league victory of England over Australia, we so seldom can beat them, they all seem to be about like the Anakims in the Old Testament, about 8 feet high and 10 feet broad when the camera moved in on them just before they marched onto the field, but we managed to beat them, in case you hadn't heard. Where was I? That's not a subject for Sunday. Will you please attend to what you're doing? Yes, well, after that, I was listening to this film on the box on Colonel Billy Mitchell. It was really a mind-blowing film if you saw it. For Colonel Billy Mitchell in the 1920s warned the United States Army, Air Force, and Navy of what was going to happen when planes flying above the speed of sound bomb Pearl Harbor. And he said that if people weren't ready for that, they were incompetent. He was court-martialed for saying that in the 1920s and died a discredited man in 1936. To the great credit of the USA, a free country, he was posthumously made a major general and was honored, though perhaps rather late in the day, for warning people of what everybody else had turned their eyes, blind eyes to. It's very interesting, isn't it? Because he was a prophet. And he prophesied the truth, and people didn't like it. What they want when prophecy comes, what they want is something very easy to hear, which makes us all feel good. And so what we want today in the churches is talk of revival. What they wanted in the Old Testament was talk of return from exile, and what we're hearing from Roy is that they got from Ezekiel and Daniel precisely the opposite. So the church's message, then, is not just wishful thinking. It is not offering the market what it wants of signs and wisdom. It's not meeting the spirit of the age. It's continuing to preach the message of Christ crucified. So if that is true about the church's message, that we refuse to conform to the spirit of the age, what about the church's membership? What are God's ways in that? Now, the basic assertion that Paul is making in this paragraph in front of you, chapter 1, 26, to the end of the chapter, is a very simple one, though it is very startling. He tells the Corinthians to look at themselves. Just look at yourself, he says, and see who you are. Now, let us join, then, the Christians as they walk through Corinth to church on the Sabbath morning. It's quite hard to get the young people there. It's an extraordinarily immoral city. It's worse than Soho, multiplied 1,000 times. It's an active trade center, and on the Sabbath, the Jews are quite ignored. They're only a tiny minority. There are bazaars everywhere. Fascinating. It's also a place extremely fond of rhetoric and wisdom and art galleries, and so they too are open and flourishing on the Sabbath morning. So as you walk with your children to church at Corinth in that first century, there's a great deal to distract you. The streets are by no means empty. Everybody is busy. When you get to church, what do you find? Well, it's a house. It's probably the house next door to the synagogue. And you find a collection of God's people. Think for a moment. Your parents have told you that these are God's people. These are people redeemed by the blood of God's Son. They're indwelt by the Spirit of God, and they're heirs of the ages. And you're a 14 or 15-year-old. Your mind is beginning to work fairly fast, and you're rather excited at the idea of meeting God's people. Very different, apparently, from all the people hustling along in the streets about their business. And you open the door and you go in with your parents and you sit through the service and you come out afterwards, and it's a tremendous anticlimax. They were so ordinary. Well, it's true that Crispus was there, verse 14, and he'd been ruler of the synagogue next door and been converted. It had hit the evening papers, but after a bit of fuss, it had been forgotten. And it's true that on the list of the preachers, which have just been given out, Apollos is coming next month, and he really is a name to conjure with. He's about the most eloquent preacher of the day. It's like having Billy Graham come on Sunday morning. So you're a bit disappointed, because when you actually get to your church and go away from it, you realize, verse 26, as Paul says here, that in the congregation there weren't many wise people. In other words, there were very few who'd been to college. And there weren't many powerful people, and the word means able, so there weren't many successful people. We wouldn't have been praying for Stephen this morning, because Stephen is a successful surgeon. And so, in the Corinthian church, I doubt if there were many successful surgeons. Nor were there many of noble birth. so there would have been no upper-class people, no leading citizens, certainly nobody with a handle to their name. So you'd have been a little bit disappointed. It seemed to be rather a ragtag and bobtail, didn't it? And that's just what the opposition said. I used this illustration last Sunday night. I haven't had it typed out again, but I'd like to read it again. It's from the 2nd century pagan philosopher Celsus. We know of him largely through Origen, who was a great Christian leader of the day and who wrote against Celsus. And he quotes Celsus as saying this. Celsus says concerning the Christians, their injunctions are like this, quote, let no one educated, no one wise, no one sensible draw near. For these abilities are thought by us to be evil. He's quoting what he thinks the Christians are saying. But as for anyone ignorant, anyone stupid, anyone uneducated, anyone who is a child, let him come boldly. End of quote. And then he goes on. By the fact that they themselves admit that these people are worthy of their God, they show that they want and are able to convince only the foolish, dishonorable, and stupid, and only slaves, women, and little children. First century. You heard something like that in the 20th century? I guess at university you did. The church isn't for able, go-ahead, modern people. And Paul says so quite frankly. He says not many of these able, modern, go-ahead people, full of ability and brains and position in society, not many of them were in God's church. You will, of course, realize, and this has often been pointed out, that Paul did not write that not any were to be found there. The Countess of Huntingdon, a very rich aristocrat who provided much of the money which kept George Whitefield going in his marvelous preaching ministry in the 18th century, the Countess of Huntingdon used to say to her friends that she was saved by an M, M for monkey. And she meant this M here, of course. That God did choose some of noble birth. But when she went to the grand parties in the 18th century, she was very much alone, as Hugh was talking about just now. There weren't many who were converted of her ilk. Now, how does Paul account for this? Does he account for it on human grounds, which is what Celsus, the pagan philosopher, did? If, in fact, you go to a meeting and you find only very ordinary people there, and you don't find any bright people, and you don't find any able people or anybody of influence in society, you come to the conclusion that this is not a very important cause. Indeed, it may be contemptible, and that's what Celsus said. But Paul never saw the local church as a voluntary association of people. Paul never thought that the church was like other human organizations that met together on a certain day at a certain time because we like that kind of thing. You know, we like organ music. We like quaint old buildings. We like singing hymns. We like drinking coffee together. We like sermons, horrors. Paul never thought of the church like that. For Paul, the Christian church is not something that you join or choose to join, but something that God plunges you into because he chose you. Look at it three times. Verse 27, God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak. God chose what is low and despised in the world. So apparently every true member of the church is not there because they chose to be, but because God chose them. It's a startling way of thinking, isn't it? I'm sure you're aware of it. When we first become Christians, we're conscious of the choice we make. But the longer we live, the more conscious we are that God chose us. I'm going to a city dinner in the next week or two, and I've been praying for the clerk of that particular company for some time, you know. I might go up to him and I might say to him, I just wish you would become a Christian. And I think he would say to me, oh, well, Dick, you know, it's not really my kind of thing. But supposing I went up to him, and I'm thinking of doing this, by the way, and I'm not sure if it would be wise, I'm not sure if he'd understand enough. Supposing I went up to him and I said, I'm longing for the day when God chooses you, because you haven't any chance of being a Christian unless he does. I think that would make him think, don't you? It would certainly be true. He might think it's rather rude, But it's the truth. Now, who did God choose, you see? Because what is true Corinth is true throughout the world. It may be just slightly different in a country like ours, which has had 1,000 years of Christian history. In the West, you see, quite a lot of wise people and important people and able people, they have some links with the church because the church is really the sort of respectable thing to do at times. That is, they go to memorial services. They have some connection. They let their children be confirmed or baptized or whatever. But worldwide, if you know anything about the living church, you will know that if you were dropped off in a parachute almost anywhere in the world, the local church would be just as Paul is describing it in Corinth. That is, God chooses many people, verse 27, who are unlettered. He chooses many unimportant people who are not able and will never get to the top of the pile. And he chooses many uninfluential people who are, well, the wrong caste or the wrong type. Yes, there were people like Crispus, there were people like Stephanus, there were people like Aquila and Priscilla, who must have been of some standing because they could afford a house, and houses were expensive in Corinth. But worldwide, what Paul says here about Corinth remains true today. What on earth is God up to? And I mean that seriously. That's not meant to be a slang question. I literally mean it. What on earth is God up to? Choosing that. After all, Corinth was going to be a bridgehead into Europe. It's fairly important whom God chooses. It's very important that this should be his shop window, so that people passing by would say, what a very impressive crowd of people. But apparently God does nothing of the kind. What on earth is he up to? Now, the answer to that is very profound as well as being very simple, and I don't pretend this morning to be able to give you the full answer, but I want you to meditate on it. I find that many of these things that I'm doing on 1 Corinthians, the pennies begin to drop the week afterwards, which is always very, very, very irritating, really. That is, I only wish they'd dropped before I preached the sermon. But let me give you a negative and a positive reason, explanation, what God is up to. First of all, the negative, which is in verse 27 and 28, and which is said in very strong language. God shows what is foolish in the world. Here's a reason to shame the wise. Verse 28, God shows what is low and despised to bring to nothing things that are. Now, my friends, I don't know what you think about that language, but it doesn't seem to me to be very respectable language. Apparently God had a purpose to shame the whole world. And God had a purpose to bring to nothing the self-important world. Why did he do that? It's very strong language indeed. But it seems to mean, doesn't it, that man's pride, man's universal pride, needs challenging, and God challenges it through the gospel. And he challenges the pride of the world on two grounds. First, its massive failure to live at peace with God or to find God at all. And secondly, its massive failure to live at peace with one another. I don't need to make that second point. It's pretty obvious if you read your daily paper. Here we are at the end of the 20th century, the most educated, the richest, the most able civilization the world has ever known. And we're totally incapable, both domestically and internationally and industrially, even in the hospital where you work, maybe, we're totally incapable of living together. I've had occasion once or twice this last summer to mention one of this century's major voices, or I suppose you could call it one of the secular prophets of the 20th century, George Bernard Shaw. There has been no voice in this century that has poured more scorn on the foolishness and weakness of the Christian gospel. But I ask you to think for a moment, how does George Bernard Shaw look now, just 30 years later? In The Spectator this week, we are told that the second volume of the three-volume biography of Shaw didn't sell, to the great consternation of the publisher, needless to say. The first volume had sold very well, the second not. Publisher doesn't know what to do about the third volume. Written by Michael Holroyd, it is not a debunking biography, which is fairly familiar today. It's an admiring biography, though a true one. Paul Johnson opines in his article in this week's Spectator that the reason very few people read Volume 2 is that Volume 1 showed him to be such an unattractive person. See, the great non-believers of the 20th century are being re-evaluated, aren't they? Their biographies are beginning to be written, and we're beginning to find that though they may have spoken very loudly, their lives were not those that anybody would have wanted to copy. Take a name more revered by millions of 20th century people than any other name, Lenin. Put that name in your mind, and then let me read verse 19 and 20 again. Will you put this name of Lenin in your mind? For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will thwart, says the Lord. Where is the wise man? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? Well, God really is thwarting this man, isn't he? Every week, statues are defaced or removed in the Soviet Union. As Trevor Fishlock says in an article this week, workers in Russia have nothing to lose but their Lenins. The name is disappearing from public squares as quickly as they can get round to it. There is serious talk of taking Lenin out of Leningrad and reverting to St. Petersburg. Can you believe it? St. Petersburg. The little metal busts of Lenin that were so treasured are now bought largely only by tourists as curious souvenirs to bring back as kitsch to your sitting room. So that a senior Soviet customs officer, seeing one in a Westerner's bag recently, looked disgusted as he opened the bag and saw it. Why do you want this, he asked. Don't you know he ruined our country? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? The negative reason of the gospel and the state and the nature of God's people in the world is to show the world that, left to itself, it is incapable of knowing God and therefore the reason for life, and incapable of managing human society peacefully and properly. So that God is constantly shaming the world, and he shames it, or ought to shame it, by his church. What then is the positive reason, as opposed to the negative reason, why God is doing this, choosing these kind of people, choosing you, for example? Well, the positive reason is given us at the end of the paragraph, and with this I'm going to finish this morning. There's lots more thinking to do, but I want to wind you up to think about it during the week, because I think it's well worth thinking about. Here's the positive reason. Because, as it is written from Jeremiah, let him who boasts, boast of the Lord. Jeremiah 9:23, don't bother to turn it up now. Now, why do we glory and boast in the Lord? What's the reason why we should glory in him? Well, only because he has done for us in his wisdom what we cannot do for ourselves. And that's what is said in verse 30. He has given us life, a new life. He is the source of that life. He has made in Christ his wisdom available to us. What is God's wisdom? By the way, that's not just four nouns, each with the same strength at the end of verse 30. Wisdom is the heading of which righteousness, sanctification, and redemption are the fruit. What is God's wisdom? God's wisdom is to give us life, and the terms of that new life in the New Testament are justification, that's the meaning of righteousness, sanctification, being set apart from God, and redemption, that means deliverance, and it is primarily eschatological in the end of time. God has set aside this people for himself. He has given them this new life. In his wisdom, he has given men what they can't get for themselves. And he has done it specifically by giving this great treasure to people whom the world regard as not very important. God standing things on their head. That means that, according to this, there will be no boasters in heaven, and therefore no bores. Isn't that a wonderful thought? Perhaps you're a member of the Athenaeum. If so, it's very difficult not to boast about it, isn't it? Perhaps you're a member of the MCC and can walk along the long room during the cricket matches. If so, it's very difficult not to boast of this, isn't it? Perhaps you're in Mensa. Very difficult not to mention it to your friends. But if we are in heaven, there will be no reason why we shall be strutting aside telling people that we are getting there because of who we were. There will be no self-made men in heaven. And it's very ominous for the Corinthians that that is so, because the church was sliding back into the ways of the world, and as we shall see when we get one day to chapter 4, and we won't look at it now, so many of them, and he uses the word again and again, chapter 4 verse 18, chapter 4 verse 19, chapter 5 verse 2, are arrogant, boastful. They're like the Pharisee. They're saying, we thank God that we're not like other men. God has done this for us. God has done that for us. We are very different from others. You see, the moment you find a church talking like that, saying we're very different from the ordinary churches that are marked by foolishness and weakness because we are marked by wisdom and strength. If you belong to a church like that, the sooner you leave it, the better. Because that church has got no future in God's eschatological purposes. That church has fallen for Pharisaism. The mark of God's church in the world is always foolishness and weakness. We shall only see its wisdom and its power in the life of the world to come. Startling things to think about? I guess so. Let's pray. Lord, our minds are stretched and our values turned upside down as we study your word. And we ask that as we have time this week to ruminate on these truths, we may begin to see how these things fit together. And we may begin to live by these new values. We ask it for Christ's sake. Amen.